We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Football Vision Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Costa, and I can't remember the last time I wasn't watching or talking about football, which sounds like a dream to most people, but if the calendar could just relax for a second, that would be much appreciated. Before we start, this episode will tackle some difficult topics, including mental health and suicide, which some people may find upsetting. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, help is available in the form of helplines and listening services wherever you are in the world, which can save lives. Thanks again for making us part of your weekly routine, and enjoy the show. For this week's episode, we've got Tom McGlinchey in the hot seat, who is an academic associate at Nottingham Trent University, currently conducting a PhD exploring the release and transition process among young footballers at academy level, in addition to teaching sports psychology. Tom, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Yep, cheers, Phil. Really good, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate being here.
It's great to have you here. And as somebody who has seen football from a variety of angles, both as a player and in your work, I'm sure you'll be able to give us an insight into this world that maybe others wouldn't. I have a keen interest in youth football myself, and I think it's an incredibly important topic to cover, especially as we continue breaking down the stigma and prejudice around mental health in general, but also look beyond the next messy sensationalism that often surrounds reporting on young players and youth football. You know, there could even be a small chance that we will be able to relate to people who have either come through similar situations themselves or may even deal with the process of academy football alongside their children in the future. Just before we get into the show, I'd like to know a bit more about you, your journey into football, and why you decided to pursue this topic in terms of your studies and now your PhD.
Yeah, so I suppose kind of going back to the start is probably the best place to kind of begin. And that's, yeah, sort of where my passion for this topic and subject started. So myself, massive football fan. It's kind of my main passion, hobby. So just started playing football kind of grassroots level. And then at the age of five, I was taken into Leicester City's academy, kind of pre-academy, just going down there once a week for a few years before you can sign schoolboy forms at the under nine level. So I was at Leicester's academy until the age of 14, at which point I was released. So there for about 9 years or so. And probably just through kind of a variety of different factors. So some personal circumstances as well. So not just purely to do with football. I'd probably lost a little bit of my kind of love and enjoyment for football, probably in the last couple of years before I was released. And probably one of things maybe kind of feeding into that, which I guess we'll come back to touch on a little bit later on, maybe probably at that age, kind of the pressure that's sort of then is quite intense within academy football. I probably wasn't the best at dealing with it back then, which probably affected my confidence and things like that. So yeah, just a variety of factors, probably lost a bit of enjoyment for the game. So towards the end of that under 14 season, my kind of parents were informed that I wasn't going to be kept on. So actually then went and had a meeting with the academy manager at the time, and due to probably previous performances that I'd put in, I was given kind of like a month till the end of the season to see if I could, yeah, kind of earn a contract for the next season. So that kind of pressure environment that I just talked about, obviously you can probably imagine how intensified that was when you've kind of got three or four games where you feel like you're trying to save yourself and your future sort of thing. Kind of had that to the end of the season. Then didn't really hear too much from the club in terms of what the plans were. So probably sort of part way into the summer, was actually called back to the King Power Stadium to have my meeting with the academy manager. And Leicester's training ground, which has actually just recently been built, was kind of in the offing at the time. So went in with the academy manager, and the first part of the meeting was things like, yeah, if you go down this corridor, you'll get to the swimming pool. If you go down this corridor and up these stairs, you get to the games room. So it kind of started quite positively. And then it was, oh, but unfortunately, we're not going to be able to offer you a contract for next season, which kind of deep down, I knew that I wasn't really playing well enough to kind of earn a contract. And if I had actually probably stayed there, I think I would have ended up quitting football altogether. So in reality, it was, I probably knew deep down it was coming and probably was kind of expected. But at the time, obviously, it's not great to hear. Probably the actual release itself, which again, I'm sure we'll come back to touch on, wasn't actually done in probably the best way. So from there, kind of went back to playing football, kind of just at grassroots level with friends, probably in a bit of a more less pressurised environment, which was really positive for me. And kind of ultimately refound my love and enjoyment for football, really loved playing again. And that's kind of led me on to having a career within semi-professional football, making a decent income from the game and that sort of thing, which is obviously really good. Then I suppose on kind of the more academic side of things, so was always fairly academic at school. Obviously, after coming out of Leicester's academy, I then went on to do an undergrad in sports science at Nottingham Trent University, which then followed on to doing a master's within sports science as well. During that master's, we had to do kind of like an original research piece. So we were presented to by different lecturers some topics that we could have potentially been of interest to us. But none of those bits kind of really stood out. So I was kind of thinking at the time what my original bit of research might be. Then during that season as well, kind of at the same time, which tied in quite nicely and, you know, might have been fate, that kind of thing. A guy that I'd actually played with previously, who'd gone on to earn a professional contract, but then been released, he'd come and joined my semi-professional team, played for about 3 or 4 months of the season, and then had to actually quit playing because he was suffering quite badly with depression. And I knew kind of through mutual friends that really was as a result of being released. So obviously for me, in kind of the longer term, it'd been a really positive thing being released and refound my love and enjoyment for football and all the things we've spoken about, but obviously kind of opened my eyes to the fact that for other people this could be, you know, a really negative thing and have some, you know, quite severe consequences for them. So yeah, obviously I was interested in the area anyway just because of personal experience. I thought I'll, you know, have a bit more of a look into this. So in kind of mainstream media, came across a couple of articles that David Conn had done in The Guardian around a similar time. So a bit more of kind of like some anecdotal stuff. Then more in terms of like the academic side, I looked into what research had been done in the area. And at the time, there'd only been two bits of research done. And one of those, which was probably, again, quite eye-opening, was some research that had been done with retained and released players. And it was looking at the psychological distress that they might experience as a result of either being retained or released. So things like markers of depression, anxiety, loss of confidence, that kind of thing. And what it showed was the released players could actually end up experiencing really severe levels of psychological distress, which in some cases would actually need input from like a mental health professional to be able to deal with that. So yeah, kind of quite eye-opening in terms of some of the potential consequences, again, that release might have. So that, yeah, that kind of just, yeah, really intrigued me, and obviously my passion for that area grew. So for my actual master's project, which I've eventually had published within academia, yeah, just looked to kind of explore the experiences of players who've been released from professional football clubs. So yeah, off kind of the back of that as well, there was some kind of more tragic cases that sort of came out. So, you know, I thought more could be done in the area to actually help on that front as well. So yeah, basically that kind of lit the fire for trying to look to do some more research in the area, which has kind of led me on to doing my PhD, which is basically just trying to explore, yeah, that release and transition process from what I believe are probably the three kind of key stakeholders in the area. So ultimately the players mainly, but then parents as well, and also from the club staff members kind of side of things. And yeah, kind of for me, the ultimate aim is really if I can help even one player who's been released to not have, yeah, such a negative experience, then it will kind of all be worthwhile. So yeah, hopefully kind of a bit of an overview of, and background on myself there.
Yeah, it's really interesting, like I said, because you've seen football from both sides. And unfortunately for me, my career peaked in year six as the top scorer at St. John's Primary School in North London. But obviously you were slightly more successful in terms of your level and potential. But even then, you see that the quality of player who still don't make it is quite eye-opening. And the cold, hard facts of football and academy football is, look, obviously, whatever career or profession you do decide to pursue, reaching the top of your field is an incredibly difficult thing to do. It requires dedication, sacrifice, resilience, and probably a bit of luck along the way. Football is no different to medicine, law, construction, gastronomy, but the numbers still feel quite sobering somehow. And I've got some numbers here to kind of read off to you. Obviously, you'd know these, but maybe to the listener, these will be new and maybe shock them like they did me, having read them for the first time. According to Michael Calvin, author of No Hunger in Paradise, which was a book released in 2017 around this very topic, there are a lot of stats included into this book. And he said, of all the boys who enter an academy at the age of 9, less than half of 1% make it to a professional level, which is incredible. I mean, just less than 1%, less than half of 1%, sorry, which is just mind-boggling. Recent stats show around 10,000 young players aged between 9 and 12 years old are currently involved in academies across the UK. So what that effectively means is less than 100 of those will sign professional terms at any club within the top four divisions, not just Premier League clubs. And arguably the most damning statistic is that only 180 of the 1.5 million players who are playing organised youth football in England right now will make it as a professional Premier League player. That's a success rate of 0.012%. Pretty much the sort of chances of you being hit by a meteorite on your way home. So just putting those into context, you see how competitive and cutthroat this industry can be, which I think is only getting more and more demanding with each passing season. And it's entirely understandable how being engrossed in academy life, following this dream for 5, 10, even 15 years can have an effect on you only to lose it suddenly. It's perfectly understandable that this can cause issues with your self-confidence and identity. Just a question, is it conceivable that the way things are going, this will only get worse if proper plans and initiatives are not put in place?
Yeah, so I think kind of all of that's true. And obviously, yeah, the more players that actually play, obviously the stats kind of are going to remain probably quite similar. So I guess for me, my thoughts on this really are, the reality is release is going to happen to the vast majority of players within academies. The stats tell us that, and like there's no real getting away from that fact. And probably the other thing I'd kind of say to that effect as well is no one's forcing players to be part of an academy. And on the whole, they get amazing experiences. You know, they go abroad on tours, which, you know, for some kids, that might be the only way that they're ever going to go abroad. They get the best coaching, they get the best facilities. And, you know, for the majority of players, their overall academy experience is wholly positive. I think it's just sometimes when players are actually released, maybe the way it's done, that's what maybe leaves kind of that bitter pill in their mouth and, you know, makes them lose that love and that passion for football. So for me, kind of one of the most alarming things really is the amount of players that the game actually loses because of their negative experiences of release. I think that's really one of the saddest things to me. And, you know, they might not go on to be a player, but what they might be able to do as a coach, as an analyst, sports scientist, whatever it might be. So I think, yeah, one thing we kind of do know around the kind of release process is, this is probably wrongly, but players perceive being released as a failure. So their dream is to become a pro footballer. If they get released, they've not achieved that. Therefore, that means they're a failure. So probably one of the things that I'd say around that as well is, one of the reasons why they view it as a failure is because, due to such kind of early professionalisation, so going into academies, you know, from the age of probably 4 and 5 these days, plus maybe like the sacrifices they might make to social parts of their lives because they're training, you know, 3 to 4 times a week, plus having a game at the weekend, and things around, you know, the educational aspects of their life where they're coming out of school a day a week once they get to the age of 12 on the day release programme. That means they end up having a really foreclosed identity around being a footballer. So they just purely see themselves as a footballer. You know, that's their dream. That's what they want to do. And if they do get released, it's then like, well, I've lost that identity. You know, what actually am I now? So again, for me, it's kind of like in any other walk of life, the stats that you were just talking about there, you know, would anyone actually pursue that as a profession? I'm not really sure. So in terms of things, maybe, you know, like what can be done. So probably firstly for me is realism. So every player and parent, and maybe especially for the parents, because, you know, depending on their socioeconomic background, they can view it as sort of a way out of that. And also sometimes what we find is parents sort of living vicariously through their child as well. So at the start of that academy journey and sort of repeatedly at milestones along it, I think there probably needs to be a bit more realism that, you know, at some point this journey is going to come to an end and it's likely to be on this academy journey. To maybe soften that a little bit, one of the things that could potentially be done is, you know, whether you get released this year or at the end of a 20-year career and you're able to retire sort of on your own terms, you're going to have a lot of years of your life left outside of football. So, yeah, just one of the aspects to maybe look at it from, just being a bit more realistic. And then in combination as well, I think, and again, this isn't something that's going to happen overnight and it's not very easy, but a bit more of a cultural shift to more of a focus on the holistic development of players. So, for example, the development of them as a person. So, you know, the communication skills that they're going to gain, the discipline that they've got from, you know, attending training 3 or 4 times a week, the commitment that gives them, their timekeeping to be on time, all those different things, you know, being part of a team gives you as well. Yeah, that's going to be a major point. And I think one of the things as well that we know from this, so Nick Cox, who's the Manchester United Academy director, he actually talks about this, and there's sort of an article on this on the Training Ground Guru, which, you know, I think is well worth a read as well.
Just if you've heard some knocks at the door there, as you know, things don't always work out the way you plan, and Tom's car actually has a chip in the windscreen, and he was told that between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. tonight that would be addressed. So naturally at 11:34 in the UK today, the knocks are coming at the door. So if you can hear some knocks, it's not a ghost playing tricks on you, it is Tom. But unfortunately he was talking through the knocks, so I won't be able to edit those out. Just quickly moving on, obviously there's no need to mention any names, but having been in that space, have you seen anything firsthand about this effect on players? I mean, even through yourself or close friends, and what it can be like to be released? I know you touched on it there. There were some confidence issues, identity issues, even feeling like a failure. If those aren't dealt with properly, how can they sort of hamper and manifest later down the line into your everyday life?
Yeah, so I guess kind of the main things you see really were shown in kind of the research that I did, as I said, as part of my master's, which was eventually published. So I guess one of the things to probably say is the initial contract meeting where the players find out if they're being retained or released, and obviously in this case the players were released, that's usually quite a traumatic experience. So it kind of, you know, whether you've got some idea that it might be coming or not, the actual kind of permanence of that decision being told to you, you sort of, yeah, kind of go from this everything to nothing thing. So, you know, 5 minutes ago I was a footballer and now it's, you know, what do I kind of do next? So that initial kind of emotional reaction does happen, you know, which can be sadness, can be feelings of anger as well. And yeah, just that kind of initial kind of unknown feeling of, you know, what's next to come. One of the things that did come from the research, which was probably quite surprising actually, was the actual maybe more severe psychological effects of being released actually tended to come sort of 6 months to a year post the players actually being released. So, you know, once they had actually left the clubs and were maybe, you know, looking for trials at other clubs or maybe trying to move into a different career, that actually dealing with those effects happened a lot later. So players we spoke to suffered, you know, quite badly from depression, anxiety as well, definitely a loss of confidence, both footballing wise and just in their personal lives as well. And definitely, as I kind of mentioned and alluded to earlier, that identity crisis is something we do see quite a lot. So yeah, if obviously those effects aren't dealt with, that's going to be quite a major issue. But probably one of the real positive things that have, kind of came out of the research that we did was the kind of positive effect that counselling could have for these players. So a couple of the players that are interviewed, one of them used the PFA's counselling service and found that really beneficial, and another player just used a more independent counselling service and actually found that, you know, talking about it, and again, try not to kind of blow my own horn here, but the interviews that we do with players, they do tend to find it quite a cathartic experience, and it's usually one of the only times they actually do talk about their release and go through it in detail, and they usually find that that's, you know, really helpful for them and helps them to make sense of different things. So yeah, maybe using those independent counselling services, using the PFA's counselling network as well, I think that's something that should be really pushed as something that can, you know, help these released players deal with any of the psychological impacts it might have.
And just to touch on your experiences again, we spoke yesterday about your experiences at the Leicester Academy. You mentioned them before. I'm not going to say you thought your release was a relief, but maybe your experience of the release process was slightly more positive than negative in terms of your situation at the time. Could you just expand on that slightly and what your thinking was during that moment?
Yeah, so again, I'd say probably kind of initially, so as I kind of mentioned, was kind of originally told by my parents that, you know, was to be released. And at the time then, again, like I just kind of mentioned, there was a real immediate emotional reaction, you know, really upset, you're really hard on yourself, you're really down about it and that kind of thing. Then, as I said, I kind of had a month to the end of the season to try and earn a contract again for myself. And probably ultimately deep down, I did really know, you know, that I was playing within myself. It kind of gets to the point a little bit, and speaking to other players, this can be the same as well, because it's such a pressurized environment, and that's, you know, that's just kind of the nature of the beast. There's no real getting away from that, and you feel like everything is kind of being judged, sort of every training session, every game. Sometimes it could get to the point where you'd maybe not even try and get on the ball or try different things for fear of making that mistake, to the point of you kind of withdraw into yourself so much that, you know, you're not really doing anything that comes naturally to you. So, you know, for me, that's one of the reasons why I wasn't enjoying playing football, because I just wasn't trying to be involved in the game or that kind of thing. So actually, in terms of being released in the end, at the time, you know, was because I probably had like a few months to actually kind of digest the fact that I probably was going to be released. And yeah, like I said, ultimately deep down, knowing I hadn't done enough to earn a contract for the next year, I did kind of see it as a positive thing that I'd be able to go back and almost find myself a little bit in terms of what I'd been like previously at grassroots football, and, you know, going back to that level and being able to play with mates and, you know, with a bit more freedom and less pressure, that just really helped find, you know, that love and enjoyment again. And again, in terms of the research as well, one of the things we do find is, you know, probably a year post-release and even further, players do often tend to experience like some personal growth and, you know, have like a wider outlook on the world, and it's not just purely around football. And a lot of players do talk about a real increased resilience that, you know, anything else they have to deal with in life because they've gone through, you know, this kind of traumatic release and it might have impacted them in such a way, whatever else they have to deal with in their life, you know, seems a lot less than what they've previously had to deal with.
I think that's a nice sentiment to take into general life, as you said, you know, dealing through emotions and hardship and how you can come out of that a stronger person. It's all really interesting how the psychology is linked, how the human side is linked, the social side is linked. And let's not forget here, we're talking about young teenagers who could be 13, 14, 15 years old, maybe even younger. So it's impossible to kind of expect any real sense of personal development and growth by that point. So every day you're learning, every week you're learning. And I think that's a really nice way to end part one, now that we've introduced everything and given them the listeners obviously a background on you and your work, and hopefully we can tackle some difficult topics a bit more sensitively in part two. So join us then.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to part two. And as I said before, this is, you know, a difficult topic, or can be a difficult topic for a lot of people. And I think we wouldn't be doing this topic justice if we didn't talk about two players in particular, by the name of Josh Lyons and Jeremy Whiston, both of whom took their own lives after suffering from mental health issues as a result of being dropped from academy football. Josh Lyons was released by Tottenham at 16, which sent him into cycles of depression and anxiety, leaving him unable to go out with friends and even forced him home from holidays. At an inquest into his death, a coroner condemned the lack of support he received from the club, with his father later explaining how being released left him feeling like a failure and unable to move past those feelings. Jeremy Whiston, again, is a case that more people may know about, as it happened recently in 2020, has been a major catalyst in this topic, in terms of it being taken more seriously. He was released by Manchester City after suffering a serious knee injury, which effectively ruined his chances of a scholarship deal. It was said that he struggled watching his friends progress at a different pace to him, with his competitive mentality pushing him into self-doubt and an identity crisis at what life might hold for him in the future if he didn't make it as a professional footballer. These are just two tragic examples of how people can struggle to manage these feelings and emotions after release, but they are far from alone in doing so. And just to delve into some numbers again, last year, a survey by the PFA revealed that 22% of current or former players felt depressed or had considered self-harm. You know, just under 68% of them said they required support around well-being, their education and future career advice. And even a study by Teesside University in 2015 said that 55% of players released by professional clubs experienced clinical levels of psychological distress. One conclusion was that symptoms of distress often increased in the weeks and even months after release. Tom, just to ask you again, your work and research is based around the release and transition process of young footballers at academies. What do those processes involve, and could you give us an example of what that might look like? You kind of mentioned the conversations there about your contract not being renewed, but is there an official process that clubs have to go through to release a player, or is it just as simple as a conversation, maybe a sit down with your parents that says, look, this isn't working for us anymore, maybe you need to look for opportunities elsewhere or step away from this level?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, Phil. So probably to kind of start from the club side in terms of maybe how they kind of come to decisions. So what you will usually find is they kind of have like a multidisciplinary team meeting. So that'll involve, you know, academy directors, coaches, strength and conditioning, analysts, physios, all that kind of thing. And they'll be discussing players in terms of whether they're going to be retained or released for the next season. What you'll probably find is the really clear-cut ones are fairly easy. So, you know, if there's players kind of at the top of the age group who look like they've got a pathway to the first team and they're going to progress, obviously that's fairly easy, they're going to be retained. If there's players that, you know, for whatever reason it might be, psychologically, technically, tactically, etc., that, you know, are kind of struggling, again, that might be a more of an easy decision that probably they are going to be released. For those ones that are maybe on the fence, that can be harder and be a little bit more subjective. And that's probably why you tend to find, you know, some of the high profile examples like Declan Rice or Eze, you know, have maybe been released from academies and then, you know, gone on to be such good players. That's potentially why that kind of happens, because, yeah, no one kind of has that crystal ball, and it is a little bit more subjective in terms of that. In terms of then the actual kind of release processes, there aren't really too many guidelines around how they're conducted. Probably a couple of bits to make everyone aware of. So for under 16s, which is quite a big milestone where players are going to find out if they're going to get a 2-year scholarship to be full time from the age of 16 to 18, they have to be told before Christmas in the under 16 season whether they're going to be retained or released. For under 18s who have obviously had that 2-year scholarship being full time, who are then going to find out if they're going to get a professional contract, they'll find out a bit closer towards the end of the season, but do have to find out around kind of April, May time. So in terms of the actual kind of contract meeting itself, which we kind of alluded to earlier, again, that will slightly differ depending on the age group. So for the 16s, it's likely they'll have their parents in the room. So they'll come for a sit-down meeting. It might be done via Zoom as well, potentially, with their parents as well. And they'll be told, again, kind of straight whether they're being retained or released. What our kind of research has found for under 18s and maybe under 21s, so those kind of older ages, what often tends to happen is the teams gathered in a changing room and kind of one by one they'll be called to their meeting and told whether they're being retained or released, which, again, as you can probably kind of imagine, that's in some cases that's not ideal. And sometimes how myself and colleagues think about it, it's almost like a little bit like an X Factor or Britain's Got Talent audition, where, you know, you're kind of being put up in front of everyone, and, you know, that can leave you with some feelings of like humiliation, shame and that kind of thing. So within the contract meeting itself as well, something that's often comes out in the research is as soon as players being told that they're being released, they do often kind of zone out, and what else is being said in the meeting can be quite a blur as well. So again, when we spoke earlier about that contract meeting itself being quite traumatic, you know, straight away they're having those instant feelings of sadness and that kind of thing. And whatever's being said by the coaches, you know, if they're trying to give them some positivity after, it often goes really unheard from that. Once you've kind of obviously been told you're being released, so for under 16s, especially at kind of the category one, category two academies, they'll go on a lot of different trials at different clubs looking to kind of secure a scholarship elsewhere. It can be the same for under 18s, plus the League Football Education do exit trials, which helps to generate interest from other clubs. Also for scholarships in the USA and from universities in Britain as well. And there'll also be like semi-pro clubs there as well, casting their eye over players. Again, really, once they're released, as kind of touched on earlier, it's kind of a bit of a trip into the unknown. So you're trialing, you know, you're going for a game here, a week, a different place. Am I going to be offered something? Am I not? And again, the idea of what's actually coming next, you know, am I still going to be a footballer or not? That's often what leads to that kind of identity crisis as well. As we've touched on, those kind of psychological difficulties that players can have, they often tend to come a bit further down the line, so maybe 6 months to a year after. And obviously, again, as we mentioned, counselling can be really beneficial for players in terms of that. I think another thing which is kind of quite important to touch on is, and again, kind of know this from the research as well, is that often players feel like their parents are really supportive and, you know, they do provide emotional support for them. But quite often players feel guilty about being released, that, you know, their parents have sacrificed so much. You know, they might have been going to an academy for 10 plus years, three or four times a week. And the fact they've not kind of been able to repay them by not making it as such, that can leave them feeling quite guilty and often leads to them kind of bottling up their emotions because they don't want to burden their parents, you know, with those emotional difficulties that they might be experiencing. And again, in terms of kind of that club support, the research we found and previous research as well tended to see that players maybe didn't feel like they were supported in the best way by clubs, and it was quite often like a token gesture. And again, I'm sure we'll touch on this shortly, but it probably comes back to this idea of like received versus perceived support. So what the clubs might think they're offering might be quite good, but if the players don't perceive that is what they need or what they want, then, you know, they don't actually feel like they're receiving that support. So I think, yeah, it's quite an important point to touch on.
Just referencing the study I mentioned before from Teesside University, what falls under the definition of psychological distress and how can we best identify it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So again, that research was by a guy called David Blakelock, who's done some really good research in the area. So psychological distress, especially in the work he's used, and again, we've used this in some of our ongoing work, is from a questionnaire called the General Health Questionnaire. So it's more of like a clinical psychology questionnaire. So psychological distress can encompass feelings of depression, anxiety, loss of self-worth, loss of self-esteem, loss of confidence, and that identity crisis as well. So all of those things are covered by this questionnaire. There's 12 questions on it. Players fill it out and it shows you over kind of the last couple of weeks the feelings they've had, and then it's done on a kind of like a scoring system, and from the scores you can tell what levels of psychological distress they might be experiencing.
Again, really interesting to kind of be introduced to this world because it's one that not many of us would have seen. Obviously there is a lot of problems with how things were handled over the last decade or two. It's an incredibly heartbreaking scenario, I would say, to be released, especially as we've mentioned, when your whole self-worth from 5 or 6 years old will have been on becoming a professional footballer. The carrot has been dangled in front of you. There will be a sense of you being treated differently as well, I would say, if you're 6, 7 years old at an academy, even going into secondary school at 13, 14, if you're having to jump out of lessons to play a match somewhere, or, you know, all of this can be a damaging cocktail, I would say. And it's clear that things need to be done. And in 2012, the Premier League launched their Elite Player Performance Plan, which was designed to transform the standard of education, of care and support that players receive while they are in the academy system and beyond. There were 6 main components to this plan, including safeguarding player safety, mental well-being, parental feedback, life-enriching experiences, and life beyond academy football. Within the mental well-being section especially, all clubs are now obliged to conduct sessions with their players and implement a mental and emotional well-being action plan. I think individual clubs have also launched their own initiatives. For example, Arsenal are working within the local community to provide therapy sessions for teenagers, in addition to helping those already in the academy with their lives beyond football on a financial, academic, and social level. Luton Town have established their own mental well-being plan, ensuring all staff within the academy are aware of their responsibility to help children and young people receive the correct emotional support. There have also been other campaigns backed by high-profile individuals. I think of Trent Alexander-Arnold launching the After Academy, which works in collaboration with Liverpool and other brands such as Red Bull, Under Armour, and Therabody to offer career opportunities and work placements across various departments. And even more recently, Ben Chilwell and Beth Mead have worked with Common Goal, who are a charity who work with players that donate 1% of their salaries to good causes and causes they might believe in. They've launched Create the Space, obviously with the goal of ensuring those within the sport have the knowledge, skills, and resources to not only prevent mental health issues, but to understand and deal with them as well. So are there any more initiatives that people have been pushing for or others that have impressed you both on a wider and smaller scale during your research?
Yes, I think obviously the ones you've touched on there, obviously, you know, kind of quite mainstream and, you know, been brought to life quite a bit recently. I think another couple of aspects to touch on as well is the idea of like alumni programs. So Manchester United have got one that's been, you know, quite heavily detailed recently in the media. Southampton as well, just to name a couple of clubs, but there'll be a lot more as well. So yeah, just kind of showcasing what other what release players have actually gone on to do career-wise and personally, and you know, using them as sort of case study examples for players still within the academy as well. So I think, yeah, that's a really, really good idea. Also, I think probably one of the main sea changes which has happened. So in 2022, Crystal Palace put in place a three-year aftercare program for released 80 under-18s and 21s players. Which was then adopted by the Premier League and EFL clubs as well. So that's definitely a step in the right direction for sure. However, probably on that front, there are a couple of issues, you know, that I can foresee with that and speaking to staff within academies as well. So I suppose firstly, in terms of that, obviously it's a three-year aftercare programme, but if a player does actually happen to move on to a new club after they've been released, at what point does that duty of care pass on? So I think that's one of the issues. And then the other issue, and I think we've definitely found this through our research as well, we know for a fact that sometimes players do disengage from clubs. So, you know, when they're released for whatever reason, you know, they associate that bad experience with that club and they do disengage. So the way I like to think of it is sort of like an ex-partner analogy. So, you know, if you split with an ex-partner, the first time you see them after the breakup and they say, you know, how are you? You're going to say, yeah, I'm the best I've ever been. And that's kind of the same for players that have been released. So because they feel like, you know, the club have done this to them and, you know, they might feel a little bit of betrayal and that kind of thing. And they associate with that kind of negative experience. If the club reaches out to them to say, you know, can we offer you anything? Can we offer you some support? It's going to be like, no, I'm okay, I can deal with this myself kind of thing. So there's a couple of things to probably think about there in terms of that aftercare program. The other thing to potentially touch on is the player's education. So for scholars from 16 to 18 who are full-time within the club, they do kind of like a BTEC diploma in sports science. So kind of every scholar in the country is doing this BTEC in sports science for what is already probably kind of the most oversubscribed degree route in the country, probably, sport and exercise science. So maybe giving players some more ownership over what education they might do between 16 and 18, something they are really interested in, or potentially a vocation, you know, so if they've got an interest in bricklaying or plumbing, doing a course like that alongside their football might actually set them up and put them in a better position than potentially just all doing, you know, the exact same education as well.
Throughout your research, have there been any key figures or individuals, or I know we mentioned Arsenal, Luton, Crystal Palace there, just any clubs in particular that you've enjoyed working with or respect their work on this subject? I know you mentioned to me privately that sometimes there isn't the amount of attention being placed on this topic that you would like. Have there been examples of the reverse happening? Somebody who really, you know, listened and sat down with you in a room and said, look, how can we fix this? How can we improve?
Yeah, to be fair, I think pretty much every club, there's a lot of people who, you know, are doing some really good work in this space. And I think that could probably be publicized a bit more. So I think, you know, everyone probably cares about this process, but you probably wouldn't be human almost if you weren't affected by this in some way. So I think a lot of clubs, you know, want to help improve this as well, and especially those organizations. So like I mentioned earlier, the PFA with their 24/7 counseling network, I think, you know, that could be so beneficial to players, but maybe it just needs to be pushed a bit more. Like, you know, do players know that that's available to them? I'm probably the same with the league football education. You know, I think they do some brilliant work as well, especially with the exit trials and all kind of the life skills packages that they put on for players. So yeah, just potentially that maybe needs to be publicised a bit more, the actual, you know, work that they're doing and the role that they play in trying to help players when they do transition maybe away from academy football.
Usually at this point, I would refer people towards any social media accounts or published work in general, but your situation is slightly different in that you aren't a journalist. Just before we finish, is there anything you would like to add or plug before we finish? And just give me your overall objectives with your work and your research. What are you really aiming to try and do, let's say, over the next 5 or 10 years that can really make a difference in terms of the release and transition process, but also the overall life of an academy footballer?
Yeah, so I think for me, kind of, as I mentioned right at the start of the podcast, I think ultimately the work that I'm doing, you know, in collaboration with clubs and organisations, if that can help to improve this process and, you know, one player has a better experience being released or they don't have psychological difficulties, you know, that we've discussed that, you know, friends of mine and, you know, people that I know have experienced, then for me, that'll have made it all worthwhile. So I think for me, kind of the ultimate aim is to try and be able to provide some really evidence-based practical implications off the back of my work. So, you know, maybe what the best practices around how to conduct a contract meeting, what aftercare maybe should look like for players, and just try and, yeah, kind of support clubs in that as well. So, you know, I think that's probably one thing to say as well. These transition processes and the release process as well, we're not saying that it's all bad, because it definitely isn't. But if we can improve some of those processes even by 1%, that's going to make, you know, those players' overall academy experiences that whole lot better. And hopefully it won't leave that bitter taste in their mouth because they've had a bad experience once they're actually leaving. So, yeah, hopefully just to, you know, try and provide some best practice for clubs that, you know, might be able to be adopted by them and by organisations as well. And, yeah, I think in terms of academy football in general, like we mentioned earlier, just maybe more of that focus on that kind of holistic development and to try and move players away from feeling like, you know, that they are a failure if they get released. And something you touched on earlier, especially, you know, for school age kids, they're known as, oh, you know, he plays for Arsenal or he plays for Manchester United. And when that's taken away, that can be quite difficult to go back to school after. So yeah, just maybe kind of trying to shift away from this idea that if you are released, it is some kind of failure. Because as we know from the stats, to even be in an academy in the first place, you know, you're in, what, top 10, 5, 1% of the country in terms of your ability. So, you know, to actually have been there in the first place, you've done amazingly well. And just to maybe highlight that a bit more and just put that bit more of a positive spin on it. So yeah, I think that's what I'd say for that.
It's a really interesting topic, and I've been a journalist for 10 years now, and this is insight I wouldn't have known about or been allowed to know about, really, because I wasn't in that world. So just thank you so much for your time. And these are important conversations that we need to keep having, because as we break down the stigma of mental health, the prejudice around mental health, talking to people is so valuable. Getting to learn about these experiences is so valuable. And hopefully as we get further down the line, we can put processes in place and really start to help these academy players with their lives, their mental well-being and their future. So a big thank you to you, Tom. I know you're busy at the moment, so I really appreciate your time, and it's been great to chat.
Yeah, really appreciate you having me on, Phil. I've really enjoyed it, so thank you very much.
As mentioned earlier, if you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, you don't need to suffer in silence. Help is available through helplines and listening services worldwide should you need them. Thanks again to Tom for joining me on this episode of the Football Vision podcast. I hope you all enjoyed it, and we'll be back next week with another show. Cheers.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.